Okay, so I'm going to be talking about a subject that's pretty closely related to, I guess, something Joe already talked about, although I'll be taking a rather different approach. So Joe was talking about fine-grained local operators coming from ADS-CFT to try and formulate some notion of bulk locality. And his main approach was to study the four-point function in pure ADS. I'm going to take a kind of complementary approach and just study the two-point function. But instead of looking at pure ADS, I'm going to look at black holes, and I'm going to look at finite NFX and try and address a similar set of questions. Okay, so the first step is just going to be to talk about how one sets up some kind of local bulk observables built out of the boundary operators. Okay, so I'll begin just in pure ADS. And I'm going to mostly stick to ADS-3, where things are a little more calculable. One can avoid unpleasant hypergeometric functions, or the hypergeometric functions reduce usually to algebraic functions, so things are a little more transparent. It also allows one to think about the black hole background in a simpler way, because the BTZ black hole is then just some kind of periodic identification of ADS-3. And I'll go on and talk about finite NFX and how we can, how those are going to look from the bulk perspective, whether they'll completely screw up locality, or to what extent we can find some modification of our mapping that makes those corrections look as local as possible, and try and estimate the magnitude of those corrections from the bulk point of view. Okay, so that's kind of where I'm heading. Okay, so at the heart of this is this idea of wave packets. If we're just thinking about ordinary quantum field theory and we're given some S matrix and we actually want to compare it to experiments in some reasonably concrete way, then we really want to build some kind of quasi-local observables and build finite time correlation functions. That's what experiments will actually measure. So we would typically do that by taking our S matrix and convoluting it with some kind of on-shell wave packets in order to build up some approximation to a finite time correlator. And this is a subject that Joe has explored. He, in 1994, he took this approach in the study of two-dimensional string theory. And there was this little description, a matrix model description, and it wasn't exactly clear what the physics was of these models, and the matrix version seemed to have infinite parameter families of what seemed like non-perturbatively consistent versions of this two-dimensional string theory. And Joe followed this approach, building on-shell bulk tachyon observables, essentially out of the matrix observables. And one of the results he found was that bulk causality, if you try and build some theory with a sensible bulk description, you render these kind of continuous families of possible models inconsistent. And it was only much later, when people adopted a D-brain perspective to these two-dimensional string theories based on the 0A and 0B theories, that there were, in fact, a couple of particular examples selected that have been argued to be non-perturbatively consistent. Although, How do you feel about that, Joe?
No, I think it was that, and how they closed that circle up.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Okay. Well, some people claim to have. I'm not sure. But anyhow, so we want to follow the same kind of strategy for ADS-CFT and take all these nice CFT correlators that are in principle completely well-defined. One day we may be able to compute them using lattice gauge theory or something. So in principle, we could do non-perturbative string theory if we can understand how to build real quantum gravity observables out of these CFT correlators. So we want to follow the same strategy of building quasi-local bulk observables by folding in on-shell wave packets. And in a series of papers with Alex Hamilton, Dan Kabat, and Gilad Lifshitz, we've been studying this problem to try and find an efficient way to do this using the ADS-CFT observables. So the kinds of questions we want to address are questions about quantum gravity. The main thrust of the developments in ADS-CFT has in many ways been going in the opposite direction. One is using semi-classical gravity usually to understand strong coupling effects in large end gauge theory. And that's been tremendously productive, but I'm going to follow the opposite train of thought and assume that we know something about our conformal field theory correlators and use them to study questions in gravity. Okay, so at first sight it looks like our observables are spread out over large proper lengths. So if we follow the bulk to boundary map of Gubser, Klebanov, Polyakov, and Witten, which roughly speaking looks like this, it's very simple in momentum space where you have some kind of boundary source, which is, so in momentum space, the spatial dependence is very simple, and you get some kind of Bessel function of momentum times some radial coordinate. There's some natural infrared scale that we could, say, set to the radius of curvature of the ADS space. And if we do that, we see that things are typically smeared in this radial coordinate by an amount of order this proper length. Okay, so.
Yeah, I've never really understood this argument.
Okay.
If you're in global ADS, we know how to associate CFT states for all the supergravity modes, just, you know, perturbative gravity ADS. And in particular, there are the sort of high, the modes with, you know, very short radial wavelengths, right? The high excitations of the
yeah.
or whatever. So surely you can take wave packets or, you know, superpositions
yes.
of those modes.
I've never understood that argument either. But. I think Joe made the same argument to this talk. So.
All right.
Well, yeah, I mean, you might say that, you know, typically an interaction energy might be of order your infrared cutoff, and then that would lead to this smearing. That is, I think, the kind of worry that Steve Giddings has expressed in the past. So. Okay. But yeah, you're right. It at some level, it really just boils down to group theory if we're in empty ADS.
The group theory, though, would work even in the weakly coupled gauge theory, where
yes.
we know there is no local bulk. So
yes.
it's something more than just the group theory.
That yes. That will show up when I look at black holes, but yeah. But in pure ADS, yeah, just looking at the two-point function, the conformal symmetry will guarantee you something that looks local on some kind of ADS geometry, but if you then looked at multi-point correlators, there's a priori no reason that the kind of interactions you would need in your gravity theory would look local. Okay. Let's see. So, okay, so we developed this coordinate space bulk to boundary map focusing on the case of Lorentzian ADS, which is a little different from the mapping originally proposed by Witten and others, which was really focusing on Euclidean ADS. Okay, so one of the new features you have in Lorentzian ADS, of course, is you get an invariant notion of time-like and space-like separations. So the first thing we did was to see that you can collapse this kind of convolution over the boundary in order to define some local bulk operator to points that are just space-like separated from the bulk point. Okay, so if you take a bulk point and draw light rays heading towards the boundary, the first thing you notice is you can, you only really have to integrate over points inside that that light cone.
David, do you mean space-like? You mean space-like and null?
It includes null, yes.
Null. In fact, the Green's function is sort of singular on the boundaries. The null part is important, isn't it?
No. It will go to zero.
Goes to zero. Doesn't the null part have to be important just because if it wasn't, then you could perturb the initial data of the solution in the null part?
Well, we'll see in a second exactly how it is important, and that will be one of the main parts of the talk. So. Okay, so we get these points that are space-like separated. Then we notice we can clean things up even more. We can take these convolutions and actually just analytically continue the spatial boundary coordinates to imaginary values and just get a convolution of a disk over a disk on this complexified boundary. So it's similar to doing a continuation to De Sitter space and viewing the boundary of ADS as the past boundary of De Sitter space. And then the so-called smearing functions we set up are related to the retarded Green's function and De Sitter space. Of course, that wouldn't really be a derivation because you need to be careful with your branch cuts and what have you. But it is nevertheless true that we can do this continuation from this case of space-like separation to this disk in the complexified boundary. And from now on, I will set the conformal weights to integer values so I don't have to worry about branch cuts. So I'll just be working with functions with poles and instead of branch cuts. Okay. The size of this disk is determined by the radial position of the bulk observable. Okay, so it gives us holography in a kind of very manifest way. If we insert some bulk observable at some given radial position, all we have then is some integral over boundary operators where the size of the disk that we're integrating over is directly related to the radial position of the bulk observable, and the center of the disk indicates the position of the other coordinates. Okay, so with this formulation, you can put in UV and IR cutoffs, and they leave you with bulk observables that are still pretty well localized. Okay, so that would be something more of a concern if you were, say, adopting the Euclidean approach and just integrating over the entire ADS boundary. Okay, so let me show you how this works a little more explicitly. Okay, so we're working with three-dimensional ADS, and as I've said, our convolutions are over the inside of a light cone, so it's convenient to work with Poincaré coordinates where that looks simple. So we'll express some on-shell bulk field operator phi directly in terms of phi zero, which is going to be a conformal primary operator. Okay, so in some sense we're working in a basis where we're using normalizable modes. So this is not to be thought of as a source for a non-normalizable operator in what I'm going to be doing. So the basis we're going to be using is a complete set of normalizable modes rather than a complete set of non-normalizable modes. You can always switch from one to the other if you so desire. Okay, so this is the kind of convolution we end up with. Okay, so we're going to be taking...
Am I supposed to think of this formula as exact, or...?
It's exact, yes. This is... You can think of it as a mapping between different representations of... different bases of the same representation of the conformal group. So you have a basis in terms of arbitrary functions on a two-dimensional space, and you can map that with this kernel into a set of harmonic functions on a three-dimensional ADS space. Okay. This is something that Gelfand and others looked at in the 60s. They, of course, just did the Euclidean case, because mathematicians usually don't like Lorentzian signatures. So one of the new things that we've done is just to do the Lorentzian continuation of this work that was done long ago in the context of group theory and special functions.
You say it's Lorentzian, but then you have to do this analytic continuation, and you're integrating over a space like this, really, right?
Yes, so we have an I here, yeah.
So does that mean this is something that's valid for analytic solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation? Or something with analytic boundary data, or what class of things are we working on?
Let's see, so... ideally, I would, so one could put in mode functions here, do an expansion in mode functions, and show that this held mode function by mode function. So I'm assuming you can do an expansion in mode functions, I guess. Yes, so there are restrictions that follow from that on this.
That hold for shockwave solutions are the kind of things we often use to test causality.
Shockwave solutions.
Well, sharp edges, for example.
I mean, one would have to be careful in approaching that limit. Yeah.
So, I mean, for a 1 plus 1 bulk, this has a simple interpretation. You're just sort of switching space and time, right? You're evolving forwards using radius as time, and it has a nice causal structure.
It's not just that. That would use the green assumption, which would be singular on the light cone.
So delta is bigger than 2. So this kernel is typically growing with distance. But we're integrating over a compact range, and this goes to 0 at the edge of the disk. So
you wouldn't have y, in 1 plus 1, you wouldn't have y prime. And I wouldn't be, I don't know if that matters, but it's not just that. In one, the 1 plus 1 version would not just be that, or if you...
Oh, you mean 1 plus 1 ADS?
1 plus 1 bulk, yeah. It would not just be that you're sort of, you just switch your space and time, you're the same, so you one, one, the metric keeps the same signature, and you're just closely integrating it.
Yeah, in 1 plus 1, well, yeah, we wouldn't have any I's to worry about.
But,
yeah, but it makes things much simpler, as we'll see. So, okay.
It must be something different, because again, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, if you just integrate it with Jay said,
you just have the...
you have singularities on the... I mean, you might have some interior as well. It's not necessarily probably just the characteristics or generic mass. But it's always singular.
Yeah, you shouldn't think of this as a bulk-to-boundary propagator in this case. We're kind of switching delta to d minus delta in the usual way of thinking of things. And it changes the interpretation of things.
You right now just defined this phi of 3 variables for us, and now you're going to tell us what you're going to do with this.
Yes. So, yeah, as I said, you can do a mode expansion and check explicitly that a mode with, say, some given angular momentum is mapped to the appropriate mode function in the bulk. So,
if this mapping is not invariant under the conformal group?
It is, yes.
But I mean, this condition, it's not really, it's not a light cone, right? It's some cone that's pointed towards the boundary, so it's not, shouldn't be invariant under the EDS group.
Well, I guess you kind of have to complexify it, but it is invariant under this. It's a light cone in this complexified space, so it is going to end up being invariant
in the original ADS.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good. So this, so correlators of these boundary fields will behave in the usual way. It's a two-point function with some conformal weight in a Lorentzian conformal field theory. We will have to be careful about I epsilons in order to get things right. So you can take those two expressions I just mentioned and use a rather non-trivial hypergeometric function integral involving a couple of hypergeometric functions integrated. This was discovered in the 1920s, I think, and appeared in a textbook by ASCII in the 1970s. So I think there's probably a lot of interesting math there that is going to be relevant for developing these ideas further. I'm not sure it's been entirely worked out yet. So there's a lot of hypergeometric function integrals that are, I think, rapidly becoming in demand. Anyhow, so if we use this one we know about, we can actually exactly reproduce the bulk two-point function, the bulk Whiteman function, where this sigma is the ADS invariant distance function. So in Poincaré coordinates, it looks something like that. And to get the right, get yourself on the right side of these branch cuts, you need to make sure you're using this I epsilon prescription. Okay, so that's a prescription we can apply directly to our operators that I showed you on the other page. Okay, so far we're just in pure ADS, and that's the kind of bulk to boundary mapping I want to use to set up local observables in the bulk. Okay, so it actually turns out that if we adopt this approach, we get a very simple geometric interpretation of bulk causality by just thinking about intersections of these disks on the boundary, on this complexified boundary. Okay, so I like to study commutators of things, so we'll study the expectation value of this commutator of two bulk operators. And following on from Don's question, the singularities of the integrals involved are what will determine when this is non-vanishing. Obviously, if we were just in Euclidean signature, the commutator would always vanish. So we really need to be careful about which side of branch cuts we're on, be careful with our I epsilon prescriptions in order to compute this correctly. And we can analyze the singularities of these resulting integrals. So we take a product of two of these operators and construct the difference between them with the different I epsilon prescriptions. This analysis of these kinds of integrals was very popular in S matrix theory in the 1960s, and we can borrow some of the tools of Landau singularity analysis from that period. And you can see from that that the non-vanishing pieces of these integrals are really just going to come from endpoint singularities of the integrals when, as we take our epsilon to zero, we get some pinch of the contour of integration. Okay, so we get, in the end, very simple formulas for this commutator that are just localized on these pinches of the contour. And the pinches that...
What
is that? Well, that's what I'm about to say, I guess. So you go through all the possible singularities of the integrand that come from... So let me just be very specific. Okay, so we take two of these operators at different points in the bulk, general points. We use our boundary correlation function, just in pure ADS, and replace that, that product of two phi zeros with that. So we get some four-dimensional integral to do. And we want to see, when we look at the commutator of two of these things, what we're left with. And if you go through all the different possible singularities, you see that when epsilon goes to zero, the only real pinch happens when the edges of two of these disks intersect each other. Okay, and if you analyze that condition, it immediately reproduces the condition of bulk time-like separations. Okay, so
you should again read what was your epsilon prescription?
So we were just taking, we're working in Poincaré coordinates and taking t to t minus I epsilon. Any limits of
gauge theory?
Well, I'm only using, the only information from the gauge theory I'm using at this point is this two-point function, which we know exactly from.
Shouldn't you not expect this sort of locality in the bulk at all couplings and all ends and things like that?
That's why I'm going to look in black hole backgrounds in a few moments. But yes, that will run into that. So I'm just looking at the two-point function. So it's highly constrained in pure ADS, but it's going to be less constrained as soon as we try and do this in more general backgrounds, and that will come in. Yeah.
But so far your prescription is very much somehow tied to having this Euclidean continuation. You don't hope to get an infinite gravitational waves or some dynamical
I have not, well, I can,
or in other words,
I've looked at generalizations of this to like shock waves and this kind of thing, but.
But I mean this, even the sort of
you would need,
light cone would not be covariant and well defined in general.
Why not?
If you don't have pure ADS, then I mean,
you can trace light
cones. If you look at the Lorentzian space side of it would have been coming from this null geodesic, but the rest of it would be some space-like
curve. Yeah.
But there is no, I don't see why there should be a unique way to specify the space-like part if you have a general, sort of some general Lorentzian background.
I have not tried to do this for a general Lorentzian background yet, but I would hope one could at least do it adiabatically if things were slowly changing. And I've done it for the case of shock waves when you when you get a sudden change and you're patching together two regions. But I would hope one could find some version of this in general, because at some level it is just based on light cones. And one can define the notion of these light cones in an arbitrary background, but it's not something I've tried to do beyond what I just said. Okay, let's see, so I'll hold through that. So yeah, let me show you these pictures. So, okay, so we're looking at some kind of two-point function, and the kind of smearing we're doing is in the imaginary direction on the spatial part of the boundary and in the time direction on the boundary. So we just have these disks, which are either overlapping or not overlapping. Okay, so we can have disks that would, say, be space-like separated, and the edges obviously wouldn't intersect, and we wouldn't get any interesting pinch singularities as epsilon goes to zero, so we wouldn't get any commutator. We can even put the one disk inside another, and because we get this edge singularity, we still don't get any non-zero commutator. It only starts to happen when the edges touch. Okay, so here I've set the real part of x to zero to keep things simple, but okay, so we can ask what kind of condition the bulk separation of the points satisfies when this happens. And it so if we look at our diagram of ADS space, we have, say, one point in the center. Let's make that point. So we have this region of space-like separation where the commutator vanishes, and it's exactly as the second operator crosses this light cone that we get into this situation. So we can then keep moving it up, say, and we'll still get a non-zero commutator. We'll move through this region, and eventually we'll hit this light cone. And that's this point where the disks are about to separate. And as that happens, as this operator moves into this region. So for delta is an integer, the commutator actually vanishes for points, two points separated by that kind of distance, because there's no time-like geodesic that connects the two points. Any time-like geodesic is going to live in this white diamond. Okay, so in some sense, they're not causally connected. If you send information, it kind of bounces off infinity and remains within this causal diamond. Okay, so.
Were you using Poincaré coordinates a moment ago?
Well, I don't have to use the quantum boundary coordinates, but...
This is a picture you did on mobile.
Yeah, or if I started putting together patches of Poincaré coordinates.
And this still gets wrong signature, right? This is signature 1, 2. X imaginary.
Yeah, that's in X there. Yeah, so here we just have ordinary Lorentzian ADS. Okay, so as far as my bulk operators go, you never see the imaginary X. Okay, they're defined purely within Lorentzian ADS.
So your story about non-neutral delta is that it probably works, but it's more complicated?
Yeah, there are a lot of branch cuts to sort through, which I haven't quite sorted through yet. And these...
Across all these.
Yeah, and even these hypergeometric function identities get a little screwy with non-integer delta. You kind of define them rigorously for integer delta and then try and analytically continue. And so I'm following the same kind of spirit here. Okay, so that was just pure ADS, which in some sense was guaranteed to work, although we now have a picture that hopefully will be useful in analyzing some other cases. Okay, so I'm going to switch to the next easiest case, the case of a black hole in ADS3, so the BTZ metric. So we can switch coordinates in this formulation very easily. So to do BTZ, we'll switch to Rindler coordinates and introduce this Rindler horizon. And we'll get some different distance function that appears in our smearing functions, but it's pretty easy to work that out. And we get BTZ from ADS. So for ADS, we have this variable phi being a real number, and we just periodically identify in order to get a BTZ black hole with no spin. Okay. So we can see how our bulk to boundary mapping generalizes in this case. And there are some different points we need to worry about. The simplest case is just a point in this right wedge. So in that case, we could just apply exactly the same formula I wrote before and view this integral as over a disk kind of centered on this boundary point. Okay, so we only need to think of one conformal field theory that's living on the right here. Okay. Okay, so we can completely define that bulk operator in terms of this boundary operator living in the right conformal field theory.
Wait, can I ask a question about the pure ADS?
Sure. Again,
are there two of these,
if you have a point in the ball, two of
these light cones that come out to two disks on the boundary, or have
no.
You pick?
In pure ADS,
yeah.
Well, we just have one boundary. But we'll just have one disk, so you'll just take the time and space coordinates of your bulk points and map those to one point on the boundary, and then the size of the disk will be
so
related
the point
to
is
your
the center of ADS, and it'll be like the whole boundary or something like that.
Well,
yes.
Poincaré coordinates.
It will.
Well, no, he just said he's not.
The size of the disk will be infinite. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
What do you mean by this?
Well,
you mean that R equals 0 in Poincaré coordinates, the size of the disk is infinite.
Yes, and like, well, in Rindler coordinates as well, if we put the point there, it would be infinite.
I think that's Matt's question is, if you look at it in global coordinates, then of course there wouldn't be any unique way to project to, I mean, which side of the ADS you want to project and call your boundary. So there has
yeah.
been some large degeneracy of stuff you can do.
Yeah, yeah. There is probably more than one way. We talk about that a bit in some of our earlier papers, but I'm not sure we address that specific point. But anyway, let me keep going. Things are very simple when we're in this right wedge. They're not so simple if we're inside the horizon. If we, I guess, follow this kind of thermofield double view of the eternal black hole, we kind of have a left and a right conformal field theory. So we can play the same kind of game and write things in terms of an integral over two disks when we're inside the horizon. But actually, we can re-express this left piece in terms of something that's purely living in the right conformal field theory. If we shift the integration contour in the imaginary time direction. So this is just like going from a thermofield double to real-time thermal field theory, where you think of ordinary quantum fields, but with a non-trivial integration contour in the time direction. Okay, so a lot of people have probably seen that before, but it's a standard thing one does in thermal field theory if you're trying to set up real-time correlation functions. Okay, so at the end of the day, we can express everything in terms of just this right conformal field theory, regardless of whether we're inside the horizon or outside. So we can build what seems like completely local operators anywhere on the inside here. Things will obviously break down if we get close to some singularity where we might expect interactions to become important, but that's a very small region of the bulk spacetime. Okay, so that seems to work great when n is infinity. Okay, but as soon as we start asking about finite n corrections, everything kind of falls apart. And if
Well, I would
like to think about four-point functions or and what have you in this background, but I haven't really done that yet.
But these constructions, I thought that when you just perturbative interactions, these constructions that sort of map the bulk to the boundary get more complicated and are harder to extend.
The route I'm going to follow is to see how we kind of have to extend this when we think about how finite NFX would play a role. And it seems to lead to a kind of robust picture. It's a question I'd very much like to think about as to whether when you start looking at three-point functions and four-point functions that it remains robust, and we do expect there to be some corrections, and in particular you'd expect like interaction corrections to these kinds of functions. And
because conformal to two-point function doesn't get interesting,
Well, one point is that if delta was renormalized, it would renormalize the mass of the field, which is a local term in the bulk. So, and we could have wave function or normalization, which again would be some local term. If the metric got corrected due to interactions, we'd expect some modification of these functions. But I would like to be able to answer that in more detail, but that's going to be the subject of some more work.
Even at infinite n, this formula that you had for point on the right-hand width being just given in terms of same kind of expression in pure radius, I would have thought in the Euclidean case, this group theory would have given you a sum over integers.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about that once I get to the finite n case, but I'm essentially assuming that we're in a regime of parameter space where the sum over images is dominated by a single term, the ordinary BTZ metric.
That's not always true.
That's right. So yeah, I'm going to assume we have a big black hole that dominates the sum over the saddle points. And whenever I talk about light cones and locality, I mean with respect to that metric, not the metric of one of the image sums. But I'm going to address that point in a second. Okay. So let's start thinking about these finite end corrections and see what we get. So this doesn't show up so great here, but I'm trying to plot a two-point function as a function of time. And in a thermal conformal field theory, we get some kind of exponential decay of the correlation function. And if n was infinity, that would just continue forever. And this is kind of important for the setup of our bulk operators because, as I mentioned before, we have this kernel that's growing, typically, with distance. So if we start taking points close to this light cone, the size of this disk is going to go to infinity. And in particular, if we take points inside the horizon, we're going to get a sum of two terms that we can only really interpret as an integral over this boundary for from t going from minus infinity to infinity. Okay, so if you work out the time dependence of this kernel, it's actually exponentially growing. So it's very important you have this exponential decay of the two-point function on the boundary in order to get a finite result. Okay, so we see things should work as long as we're in this exponentially decaying phase. But the problem is that finite n effects cut that off at some given time, usually called the Heisenberg time. So if you have a conformal field theory with a finite number of degrees of freedom at finite temperature, this thermal decay will only last for some certain period, and then you'll start to see wiggles. And these wiggles will typically occur with amplitudes of order whatever non-perturbative effects you're missing. In the case of the BTZ, we're kind of throwing out all these other image sums. So we expect those to be suppressed by this small number, e to the minus the black hole entropy. Okay, so that's just a rough estimate of these effects, but we expect these wiggles to start happening at this time scale, and their magnitude will be of this order. If we wait a much longer time of order the e to the entropy of the black hole, we'll start to see these Poincaré recurrences, but they won't be relevant for what I'm going to talk about today, because I'm going to try and cut things off as soon as we start to see these wiggles and turn that into a condition for when we would expect semi-classical physics to work in our fixed BTZ background.
If you don't have a unit sum, if you do the Green function of your areas.
Well, this is including the image sum. This is the exact two-point function.
That's true, but if you didn't have the image sums in the previous expression, that correlator was, that field was just a field in your areas.
So in the previous expression, I was taking the large n limit. So
yeah, even at large n, the image sum, pi has to be period 2 pi. If you don't have the image sum, how do you implement that?
I have the image sum. Maybe we're talking about a different image sum. I have that image sum. I don't have the image sum over SL2Z metrics that are related to the BTZ metrics. So as discussed in Maldacena's paper on the eternal black hole, you include thermal ADS and actually an infinite number of other geometries related by SL2Z transformations. So yeah, that's what is included in this, and giving you these Poincaré recurrences and these wiggles. But that would obviously not make sense to try to interpret that in terms of some local effective action around the BTZ metric. So I'm just going to try and ask the question when those terms start to become important. Okay, good. Okay, so we have this time scale, which is, of order the radius of curvature of the ADS, and this central charge, which is going to go to infinity in the large n limit, but otherwise would be finite. Okay, so we see that as soon as we start looking inside the horizon of the black hole, if we use our previous definition of all these bulk observables, everything just goes to infinity. So we have an exponentially growing kernel, but the thing that it multiplies starts to wiggle. It doesn't really decay anymore. So we'll end up with something divergent. Okay, so let's try and modify this this mapping and see if we can get something that makes some kind of sense and try and interpret that. Okay, so we're trying to define some observables in real quantum gravity now. So they're kind of necessarily not going to be arbitrarily precise. We're trying to define local, quasi-local bulk observables in a real theory of quantum gravity at finite n. So we shouldn't expect too much, but let's see if we can get something that approximately works. And obviously it's not going to be unique. There are probably a huge number of different ways of modifying this kind of construction, but this seems to give us something that works. So we should regard it as a success if we can reproduce semi-classical correlators to some reasonable accuracy when expected. So obviously we can pick states in our conformal field theory that have nothing to do with a smooth geometry. So we wouldn't expect this to work at all. It's going to depend on the state in the conformal field theory we're looking at. And it's not, we shouldn't expect it to work for infinite numbers of correlators. It's probably only going to work for some given class of correlator to some finite accuracy, but we can at least use this to then try and estimate what develop some criterion for when the semi-classical approximation is going to be good. And this is kind of at the heart of the black hole information problem. So that arose essentially because we think we can trust semi-classical physics away from regions of large curvature. Okay, if we adopt that assumption and try and build local effective field theory, we conclude we have information loss. So if that's true, we should derive it from ADS-CFT. And as we'll see, this attempt to do that actually gives us a criterion that tells us that is not true, that we can't just trust local effective field theory away from regions of large curvature. There's some extra conditions that come in, and we can derive them by this kind of approach. Okay, so we basically just want to use the difference between these cutoff observables and what we would expect for the true semi-classical correlators, and use that difference as an estimate of the magnitude of finite end effects. Okay, so yeah, so I think I said all that already. Really, the best you can do is kind of optimize. You want some large number of observables that work with some reasonable accuracy. To some extent, that is going to depend on the question you're interested in. Okay, so let's see how we do. Okay, so we expect our bulk correlators will get corrections perturbative in 1 over n and non-perturbative in 1 over n. We expect these perturbative corrections to be incorporated into some kind of renormalization of local terms in our effective action. And there are a number of papers that kind of address this point. There's an interesting one by Aharoni and Komarkotsky where they look at deriving the kind of bulk OPE from the CFT OPE. Steve Giddings and others have addressed these kinds of questions in detail, looking at the four-point function, and Joe and Zhao have been kind of continuing that work, and Joe spoke about that recently. Okay, so let's assume that that isn't going to, these perturbative corrections aren't going to screw things up too much. They will screw things up a bit, but let's at least see what we can learn by looking at the two-point function. So in particular, terms non-perturbative in 1 over n are not expected to look local at all. Okay, so we have contributions, for example, coming from thermal ADS and what have you, where the metric is completely different from the BTZ metric, and we wouldn't really want to try to think of that as local. The corrections might be viewed as local around some other saddle point, but the philosophy I want to follow is just to declare the effective action dead if these other terms start to become important. Okay, so the quantity most sensitive to these corrections ought to be the commutator of bulk fields. So let's compute that using this prescription that we've been discussing. Okay, so a sure sign that our local effective action around the BTZ metric is broken down is if we start to see some kind of substantial commutators or even any commutators at space-like separations. Okay, so let's think this through then. So our cutoff is basically going to be a cutoff on the size of the disk we're talking about. So we're going to cut it off at a radius of order this Heisenberg time. Okay, so suppose we look at points in this right wedge and compute the commutator. Okay, so essentially we're computing the difference between the semi-classical, the difference using the semi-classical two-point function with versus the what we would get using the exact two-point function, but cut off the Heisenberg time. Okay. So if the points are outside this right wedge and sufficiently far from the horizon with a radius bigger than this value, the cutoff actually doesn't enter in at all. Okay, the size of the disk is smaller than the Heisenberg time. So we can follow through the exact calculation we did before and conclude we get a commutator vanishing at space-like separations. So that's kind of nice. With this cutoff prescription, even though it was somewhat ad hoc, we have this whole region of space-time of infinite volume where things still look exactly local. Okay.
So given you want to use a two-point function, there are two disks.
Yeah.
And your cutoff is on the radius of each disk separately?
Yeah.
No matter how far apart they are on the boundary?
No matter how far apart they are. That's right, yeah. Well, I'm not sure I'm answering that. Cutoff is really on this boundary correlator that's appearing. So that, it does depend on the time difference.
So if I had two points at the same R, which was, you said that the cutoff is irrelevant, but the time difference was extremely large, then the cutoff would be relevant.
That's right, yes, sorry. Yeah, so let's see, going back to this, oops. So this is this boundary correlator. So yeah, I'm just putting a cutoff there and throwing this away and using the difference between a semi-classical correlator evaluated for arbitrary times and this cutoff answer as an estimate of the finite end effects. Okay, I seem to have run out of time, but let me just finish up. Good. Okay. So things, we get a commutator that's non-trivial at space-like separations when we go inside this radius. The actual distance we get is some obscure number that's going to be actually smaller than the Planck scale if the central charge is very large. So we would expect interactions, I guess, to thicken that when we to something of order the Planck scale. So I'd like to see in more detail how that happens. But we do get some cutoff that's localized to this to a time-like surface that's very close to the horizon. So that's reminiscent of black hole complementarity, and you can compute the Okay, so we see bulk causality for this whole region where R is bigger than RC. Inside this region, we see something that looks like a stretched horizon, and it doesn't actually matter if we go way inside RC. Things essentially behave the same way. We can compute the magnitude of this commutator and see that it's actually of order e to the minus the entropy of the black hole. So this Heisenberg time is basically defined by the point at which the correlator has decayed, the boundary correlator has decayed to something of order that magnitude. Okay, so this is the same kind of order of magnitude as you would expect from contributions of different topologies. Okay, so it's here we're seeing a kind of interesting picture. These topologies seem to be playing a role, but they don't screw up causality if we're outside the black hole. They only screw it up if we start to get too close.
But then we're inside the black hole, so outside the horizon, you still, the causality is broken?
Well, we see a very small commutator. So you might then debate whether that's big enough to cause you problems. And if you're inside the horizon, the story, I think, is that you only have a finite lifetime. So that limits the accuracy of any measurements you can conduct. And I don't think you can measure anything to order that accuracy. So. Okay. If we have unitarity, we expect to get certain correlators where these effects will add up coherently. But in general, we're going to need of order e to the s black hole operators in order to get them to add up coherently to get some effect of order one. But we certainly expect local effective field theory to break down if we're adding these corrections coherently. So that gives one class of correlators in our effective field theory that we just can't compute using a local effective field theory. We would really need to resort to the exact conformal field theory two-point functions. Okay, so we can conclude that local effective field theory works very well around any local region of space-time. If we pick some region outside the black hole, we get exact causality. We do get some small corrections to our correlator, but that's not going to be a very large error if we're only looking at small numbers of local operators. Okay, so it seems like we have local general covariance, at least if we're away from regions of large curvature. But we have other situations in which a local effective field theory is going to break down. So if we try and extend it to as large a region as we can, we do see we get a breakdown of local effective field theory if the time separations become too big. And we also see a breakdown if we look at very special correlators where these small effects that we're dropping add up coherently. And that will typically involve very large numbers of operators in our conformal field theory. Okay, so that kind of ends the story about the BTZ black hole. And I had a few speculations about small black holes that I could just end up with in a few minutes. So that seems to make sense for the BTZ black hole. I mean, there's always the question of whether interactions are going to change the picture dramatically. But I would hope one could find some modification of this cutoff set of observables that would still work in the interacting case and give you the same basic conclusions. So let's suppose we try and apply it to small black holes and make some speculations on how it might work. Okay, so if we're doing a black hole in ADS, the problem we have with a small black hole is that low temperatures, the ensemble is not dominated by small black holes.
Is the term small black hole defined for ADS3?
Well, if the temperature is too small, it gets dominated by thermal ADS.
True.
Yeah, so. Yeah, you still have a kind of Hawking page phase transition. Let's suppose somehow we can find some chemical potentials to fix our ensemble or put it in a box somehow, as I guess Gibbons and Perry did a long time ago. Find some way to do that in ADS-CFT. So if we can do that, let's also suppose that the two-point function in this modified ensemble that somehow is dominated by these small black holes has this kind of thermal behavior with T, the Hawking temperature. Okay, So if we assume that, we're going to basically get the same time scale appearing, the black hole entropy divided by the Hawking temperature. And if we were to do it in four dimensions, a four-dimensional bulk, we'd get something of order the lifetime of the black hole. And this time scale has appeared many times in the black hole literature. It's been called the information retention time in work by Page and Susskind. And with Lars Thorlacius, we showed that this argument works actually in general dimensions. So you get something of order the lifetime of the black hole. And that corresponds to the kind of time scale that you would expect from information theory, at which information starts to be released in the Hawking radiation. Okay, so suppose we could generalize our bulk-to-boundary prescription and apply it to this slowly changing geometry using some adiabatic approximation. We'd expect the same kind of results to go through for commutators of operators, and we'd end up with the same kind of conclusions for effective field theory. And these statements about the magnitude being of order e to the minus s and the kind of time scales that appear matches what you get from information theory. We get a more refined picture looking at these correlators in it coming from ADS-CFT, but the basic idea matches what you would expect, just thinking of the black hole as, say, a radiating lump of coal and trying to figure out how much information is released in the radiation. Okay, so let me finish up. Sorry for going over. So we found this nice geometric picture of bulk causality in terms of these disks intersecting with each other. We get some family of quasi-local bulk operators even at finite n. So in pure ADS, they would be local in the BTZ case. We see their local outside region, outside horizon regions. And we get an effective action that emerges when we look at these correlation functions that matches expectations from black hole complementarity. Okay, so some other questions I'd like to look at. Perhaps this case of general delta to make sure things are on a firmer footing. And also, probably related question is to start thinking about 3 and 4 point functions and looking at some of the things that Zhao and Zhou have considered and see if this kind of picture will survive when we try and include these. So, thank you.
My question about your story at finite end. When you include some dominant saddles, you're imagining somehow correcting your kernel, yeah, and then still defining bulk points. Because if you're computing kernel expectation value of the commutator for bulk points, how do you tag the bulk points across different manifolds?
Well, I think I said I didn't want to do that. So,
you have to do that to even make sense of the statement that you're computing the leading value of space like
Well, so I want to think of it just in terms of one dominant metric and defining some kind of effective action around that fixed background, essentially. Just do perturbations around some fixed background, which in this case was the BTZ background. So if there are those other corrections, I would want to either interpret them as local corrections to this effective action, or if there are small non-local corrections, then I would say, well, let's not put them in the effective action, and we'll worry about, well, we'll just say that we can't, our effective action is only good up to some given accuracy. So I would only want to have local terms and an effective action around some fixed background.
Okay, thank you again. Good.